Picture this, it is June 4, 1942. You are at roughly 15,000 feet over the Central Pacific, and the blue water below you is so perfect it looks painted. Your pilot has just pushed the nose over into a 70-degree dive, and everything in the world has narrowed down to the crosshairs of a Mark III gunsight and the deck of a Japanese carrier growing inside it. The dive brakes are open, you can hear them screaming in the wind, those perforated steel flaps that look like someone punched holes in them with a sheet metal drill. The anti-aircraft fire is coming up now, black puffs drifting past the canopy, some of them close enough that you can hear the crump of them over the engine noise. You are the rear gunner, riding backward, watching the sky for the zeros you know are down low somewhere, fighting their way back up to altitude. But right now, the sky above you is empty. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger. The airplane in that dive is the Douglas SBD Dauntless, and I will argue until the cows come home that it is the most important aircraft in American aviation history that nobody ever puts on a poster. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, the Dauntless SBD stood for Scout Bomber Douglas, which is about as workmanlike a name as the airplane itself. The crews had other names for it. Slow but Deadly was popular. Some called it the Barge. Neither sounds like a war winner. But that is exactly what it was. The SBD came out of the mid-1930s, developed from an earlier Northrop design called the BT-1. When Douglas acquired the El Segundo division that built it, their engineers took what worked and fixed what did not. By 1940, the Dauntless was in production and heading to the Navy and Marine Corps. It was a compact airplane, two seats, a Wright R-1820 Cyclone radial engine up front, putting out around 1,000 horsepower. The pilot sat forward, the rear gunner sat behind him facing backward with a pair of 30-caliber machine guns, 33 feet nose to tail, 41 feet 6 inches of wingspan. Not elegant, not fast. Top speed around 255 miles an hour, which by 1942 was not going to win any races. What it could do was dive and do it accurately. The perforated flaps are the key to the whole airplane. Dive bombing works on the principle that you ride the bomb down and release it close to the target instead of trying to calculate the trajectory from level flight at altitude. More accurate in theory, the problem is that in a steep dive, gravity is relentless. Airspeed builds fast. Most aircraft of that era, if you push them into a 70-degree dive, would accelerate past the structural limits of the airframe or past the pilot's ability to pull out safely. The forces in the recovery would black out the crew or tear the wings off. The perforated dive brakes solve that. Extend them going in, and the holes in the steel create enough drag to keep the airspeed in a dive manageable. The pilot could ride it down from 15,000 feet to 2,000 feet, steady in the sights, and release a 1,000-pound bomb where it would actually go somewhere useful. Simple in concept, brutal in execution. By the time Pearl Harbor happened in December of 1941, the SBD already had a shadow over it. The Curtiss SB-2C Helldiver was supposed to replace it, bigger, faster, more capable on paper. The word was that the Dauntless was already obsolete before the war started. The Helldiver turned out to be a disaster, at least initially. Structural problems, handling problems, one thing after another. The crews who eventually flew it called it the son of a bitch, second class, which gives you a sense of the affection in which it was held. The Helldiver would not enter frontline service until 1944. The Dauntless was there, it would have to do. The Battle of the Coral Sea in May of 1942 was the first real test. Dauntless crews sank the light carrier Shoho and badly damaged the fleet carrier Shokaku. They lost the carrier Lexington in exchange, which was a serious blow, but they kept the Japanese from advancing on Port Moresby in New Guinea. And they put Shokaku and her sister Zuikaku out of action for months, which would matter enormously very soon. Because Midway was coming. The intelligence story behind Midway deserves its own episode someday. The short version is this: American codebreakers at Pearl Harbor, working under Commander Joseph Rochefort at a facility called Station Hypo, had broken enough of the Japanese naval code to know that a major operation was being planned. The target was designated AF in Japanese traffic. Rochefort believed AF was Midway Atoll, a tiny coral island roughly 1,300 miles northwest of Hawaii, barely above the surface of the Pacific. To confirm it, they arranged for Midway to send a radio message in plain language, unencrypted, reporting that the island's water distillation plant had broken down. A few days later, Japanese traffic reported that AF was short of fresh water. That was all Admiral Chester Nimitz needed. The Japanese were coming with four fleet carriers. The Akagi, flagship of Vice Admiral Chuichi Nagumo, who had commanded the Pearl Harbor attack. The Kaga, the Soryu, the Hiryu. These four ships carried the most experienced naval air groups in the world, pilots who had trained for years. Some of them had flown at Pearl Harbor, at Rabaul, across the Dutch East Indies. They were the best Japan had. Nimitz set an ambush. Three American carriers were repositioned northeast of Midway and told to wait. The Yorktown had been badly damaged at Coral Sea. The initial estimate said 90 days of repairs were needed. The Pearl Harbor shipyard got it done in 72 hours. She was not perfect, but she could fly airplanes, and that was what mattered. The morning of June 4th started well for Japan. Nagumo launched his first wave against Midway. The island took damage but kept fighting. The runway stayed open. The airfield launched its own strikes against the Japanese fleet and achieved essentially nothing, but Midway kept launching aircraft. The strike leader radioed back that a second wave against Midway would be needed. Nagumo ordered his reserve aircraft, which had been armed with torpedoes in case American ships appeared, to be rearmed with bombs for a second ground attack. It was a reasonable decision based on the information he had. What it meant in practice was that the hangar decks of four fleet carriers filled up with half-armed aircraft, fueling hoses strung across the deck, bombs and torpedoes being moved around in haste. Ordnance that should have been struck below to the magazines was sitting in the passageways, out of the way but nowhere near safe. Then the report came in from a Japanese scout plane that had been delayed in its search. American ships, possibly a carrier. Nagumo reversed again. Torpedoes back on, the rearming crews went back to work. The hangar decks were, at this point, a controlled disaster in progress. American aircraft were already on the way. The torpedo bombers got there first. Torpedo 8 from the Hornet, flying TBD Devastators, found the Japanese fleet. The TBD was genuinely obsolete by this point. Slow, hard to maneuver, and it had to fly straight and level at low altitude to launch its torpedo. That meant flying in a straight line through every gun the Japanese fleet could bring to bear, while the Zero fighters came screaming down to meet it. All 15 of Torpedo 8's aircraft were shot down, not a single torpedo hit. Out of 30 crew members, one man survived. Ensign George Gay ended up in the water holding a black sea cushion over his head to hide from Japanese aircraft flying overhead. He would watch the rest of the battle from sea level, floating in the middle of it. Torpedo 6 from the Enterprise came in next. 14 aircraft, 10 lost, no hits, Torpedo 3 from the Yorktown. 12 aircraft, 10 lost, no hits. 41 torpedo bombers, 35 aircraft shot down, not one hit. For a moment, it must have looked like the worst morning of the war. But those torpedo attacks had done something. The Japanese Zero fighters, the Combat Air Patrol, had been pulled down to low altitude where the torpedo bombers were, down to sea level where the Zeros were fast and lethal, but where they also had to spend precious minutes fighting their way back up to altitude. Above the Japanese fleet, the sky was briefly, almost impossibly empty. Lieutenant Commander Wade McCluskey had been circling with 37 Dauntlesses from the Enterprise Air Group. He had flown to the intercept point the plot gave him and found nothing. The Japanese fleet was not there. His fuel was getting low. He had a decision to make. He turned southwest. He spotted a Japanese destroyer, the Arashi, steaming hard at high speed on a northeast heading. She had been chasing an American submarine and was now racing to rejoin the main fleet. McCluskey followed her wake at almost the same moment. Arriving from a different direction were 17 Dauntlesses from the Yorktown's Bombing 3, led by Lieutenant Commander Maxwell Leslie. Leslie's squadron had suffered a maddening equipment problem. An electrical arming system had accidentally released several bombs before the attack even began. Some of his aircraft arrived with nothing left to drop, but Leslie was there and the ones who still had bombs were ready. Two dive bomber groups, different carriers, different approach angles, no coordination by radio. Almost no fuel left, and four Japanese carriers spread below them. Their decks and hangar bays packed with aircraft and ordnance, McCluskey split his group. His two squadrons took different targets. Leslie's group went for the Soryu. The Zeros were still climbing back up from sea level. They would not get there in time. The Dauntlesses rolled into their dives. Now, here is where it gets interesting. Lieutenant Commander Dick Best, leading a section of Bombing 6, saw that too many aircraft were converging on the Kaga. He pulled up, redirected, and took his division toward the Akagi instead. His bombs hit the Akagi's flight deck. One of them penetrated to the hangar below and detonated in the middle of the arming chaos. The torpedoes, the bombs left in the passageways, the fueling hoses, it all went up. The Kaga took multiple hits. Same result. Leslie's group put three bombs into the Soryu, three carriers burning, all within minutes of each other. Three of the most powerful warships in the world, each one becoming an inferno from the inside out because of the improperly stowed ordnance that should never have been sitting on those hangar decks. Nagumo transferred his flag from the burning Akagi to a cruiser. Her crew fought the fires for hours before she was scuttled. The Hiryu survived the initial attack. Her aircraft launched two strikes against the Yorktown and hit her hard enough to put her dead in the water. American efforts to save the Yorktown, which was still afloat and under tow 2 days later, ended when a Japanese submarine put torpedoes into her. She went down on June 7th, but Dauntlesses from the Enterprise found the Hiryu that same afternoon of the 4th. Four bomb hits. She burned through the night and sank before dawn. Four Japanese fleet carriers, all of them gone. Japan lost 248 aircraft and the air crews that flew them. The experienced pilots who had ranged across the Pacific, who had bombed Pearl Harbor and Darwin and Colombo, were gone at a rate Japan could not replace. She could build more ships eventually. She could not rebuild that experience in the time she had left. America lost the Yorktown, one destroyer, 147 aircraft, and 307 men. Midway did not end the war. Three more years of brutal fighting remained. The Dauntless flew through most of it. It operated from Henderson Field at Guadalcanal under conditions that would have been considered impossible, flying missions against Japanese ships trying to reinforce the island at night. It fought at the Battle of the Philippine Sea in 1944. Over 5,800 SBDs were built in total. The Helldiver finally replaced it in frontline Navy service in 1944. The Helldiver's problems eventually sorted out. The Dauntless had outlasted every prediction about its useful life, and then some. It had sunk more Japanese shipping than any other Allied weapon of the Pacific War. Wade McCluskey was awarded the Navy Cross. He retired as a Rear Admiral. Dick Best, who led the attack on the Akagi, contracted tuberculosis from breathing smoke and fumes in that dive. He spent years in a sanatorium and never flew combat again. He lived to be 91 years old. George Gay, the sole survivor of Torpedo 8, was recovered by a Catalina the day after the battle. He kept flying, kept serving. John Waldron and the men of Torpedo 8 were not coming home. But without their sacrifice, without the attention they forced from the Japanese Combat Air Patrol, the Dauntless pilots might have arrived over a sky full of zeros instead of an empty one. History is not comfortable that way. A few Dauntlesses survive today. The National Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola has a restored SBD on display. The National Air and Space Museum has one. If you ever stand next to one, look at the dive breaks. Look at those perforated flaps, all those holes punched in the steel. That is the engineering that made 4 minutes matter. My sources today include Gordon Prange's Miracle at Midway, Walter Lord's Incredible Victory, and the historical archives of the National Naval Aviation Museum. Find us anytime at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger.